Hi, I'm Kevin Flynn, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about episode 5 of the team's latest series on the state versus Jason Carroll, which deals with the 1988 murder of Sharon Johnson of Bow, New Hampshire. Now, if you haven't listened to that episode yet, this conversation might not make a whole lot of sense, so make sure you go back and do that before listening on. Today I'm joined by Rabia, who is the lead investigator this season. Rabia, great to have you back.
And welcome back yourself, Kevin.
Yeah, I apologize. I have a bit of a cold, so I'm gonna push through. But I apologize to the listener that do not unsubscribe to the podcast just because.
Don't adjust your audio. That's just what's happening today.
Yeah.
But I hope you feel better soon. And this is payback for having a wonderful vacation while the rest of us were stuck at home.
Yeah. Thanks to Colin Miller for filling in. So let's talk about episode 5. And I love the beginning because you talk about Kojak. Now, we've already kind of gone down like these rabbit holes on about Quincy and other stuff, but we keep somehow having 1970s police procedurals come up. I got to ask, did you watch Kojak when you were a kid?
I was vaguely aware of Kojak as a character in a series, but I never watched it. Look, I grew up in an immigrant household when my parents were like, we don't watch TV. Like, do your homework, do your chores, go to bed. We didn't watch anything.
It was a little before my time, but I was aware because, like, in the late 70s, I mean, there wasn't a lot on TV, right? So shows during the daytime, like, what was going to be in syndication, there wasn't a huge pool to draw on, so it was, like, a lot of primetime stuff. So during the day, sometimes you'd see Starsky and Hutch,
right,
or the Rockford Files, or Beretta, or Kojak, or the Streets of San Francisco. And these were all, like, fantastic, or I should say iconic police shows, although I can't really remember a lot of about that, but I do remember that when they try to be cutting edge, it's like, this child might be a victim of child abuse. And like, oh, you know, it's like an ABC after school special.
Yeah.
No one ever talked about child abuse or whatever.
But look, they left huge impressions on like our collective psyche, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. About what the iconic detective is like, how investigations happen, how they catch the bad guys, how prosecutors operate. I mean, like that really had a huge impact on how society understood the justice system.
Yeah, and we had a discussion, you know, culturally in the past year about copaganda and where this comes from. And I think in this era of television, it's when we have detectives that break the rules because the system doesn't work.
Right.
And that we can't get the bad guys because things like civil rights
matter.
Right? This Miranda thing or, you know, search warrants. What is that about? So we're going to kick the door down. And while it was entertaining, I'm sure, and very different from Dragnet and other things that were around, cop shows that were around in the 60s, it was sort of the beginning of where culturally we were willing to accept bad behavior on the parts of fictional detectives and fictional cops, which led to we're okay with real cops, you know, doing that. And maybe people growing up who became law enforcement officers, they learned how to do that stuff or assumed what the culture was from watching Cops and watching NYPD Blue and other ones where the cops are kind of on the line there about what they do, right?
Yeah, because I mean, look, the good guys and bad guys are clearly delineated in this. You're not getting like any kind of sympathetic portrayal of, you know, any suspects or defendants.
Right.
I mean, it's so clear. I mean, and that's why, you know, we became tolerant of bad behavior from people that we thought were essentially good people. And we do that across all kinds of, you know, all kinds of spectrums, political and otherwise. But yeah, I mean, it was this character, Kojak, the name came up over and over again when I asked people to tell me about Detective Sergeant Roland Lammy, who's a legend in New Hampshire, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably one of the biggest reasons why he got that nickname was physically, that he had a big bald head, which is what Telly Savalas was. And, you know, it doesn't even if you're not a cop, I'm sure if you went like with a shaved head, For several decades, people would call you Kojak. But look, you introduced us to one of two really important characters in this story, this episode, and one of them is Sergeant Roland Lammy. Lammy already had an impressive career and record when he was handed this case and took an unconventional approach to the investigations he had. He didn't review the case file. Instead, he spoke to the prior investigators, found out who had not been interviewed, and then went looking for people that the police hadn't spoken to. So I want to let you know that I had actually at one point interviewed Roland Lammy because one of his cases was in one of my books.
Oh, wow.
And this was the book was called Our Little Secret, and it was a cold case, and it was a shooting that happened in 1986. Roland didn't come in later. He was one of the original. I think he came in like a day later. He was one of the original investigators, but it was a case that did go cold. If you would indulge me, Rabia, to plug my book. Is that all right?
Yeah. I want to hear about this. Sure.
Okay, so the story was that in November 1986, there was a man by the name of Daniel Paquette. He lived in Hooksett, New Hampshire, not far from Bow, where the Johnsons live. And he was out in his backyard welding a bulldozer. He was a welder by trade. And a bullet came out of the woods and struck him from at least 500 yards away from the tree line. Got him square in the chest just as he stood up. And he was exposed in the cab on the other side of the trailer. Now, it was the first day of hunting season, and a lot happened where they just, you know, could not believe that. No, I shouldn't say that. Actually, Lammy did. Nobody else could believe that somebody could make a shot like that on purpose, that he could get hit, you know, in that instance, from that distance. And it would have to be straight on, because if you came from any other angle, if you came from 5 degrees, 10 degrees from a different angle, it wouldn't hit because he was protected, right? So he pursued this case that eventually led to Lammy ended up making his way towards the stepdaughter of Daniel Paquette. Now, while there were a whole bunch of other red herring suspects, you talked about red herrings as well previously, it ended up being that the shooter was a friend of the stepdaughter, a guy by the name of Eric Winters, who was a teenager. And in sort of a peak of a teenage, maybe we'd say testosterone, or in, you know, indignation because the world is bad, and as teenagers, you know, we want to fix the world, that he took the shot because Danny had been molesting his stepdaughter, Melanie. And so it was solved in 2004. It was long after Lammy retired. But I did have a chance to sit down with him.
How was that?
Interview him. Well, Roland Lammy is, as you've already described, is an interesting character. Mm. He, in his retirement, would take his mother, who must have been 170 years old. Every Tuesday, they had dinner at the Red Blazer on Manchester Street in Concord. He had a special table, and it was his place, and they just knew where Roland was going. And so I had it with him. I found him to be very smart, a little charming, a little devilish. Mm. And I think we get that from the idea that, you know, if someone won't come out of a building, maybe the fire alarm gets pulled.
Right.
Or maybe somebody has AIDS. I don't know, but it's a good way to get a hold of him.
That was kind of shocking, yeah.
Yeah, and he did have that. I didn't know the Kojak nickname, but he did have a reputation as being the closer, right? As being the guy that got it done, being the best detective of his era. And even though he didn't solve this case, he was, you know, very, I would say, well-respected in some regards, but he did also have that kind of reputation. There is
I actually think, you know, part of him being respected by his peers, his colleagues, was the fact that he was willing to be that guy to pull the fire alarm and do things maybe not completely conventionally. They admired him for his guts, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And there, as you may know, David Souter, former U.S. Supreme Court justice, was from New Hampshire, was on the New Hampshire State Supreme Court before that, and dealt with a lot of appeals involving Roland Lammy. And the great Justice David Souter, who will go down in history, wrote, and I am paraphrasing here, on some case, that Sergeant Roland Lammy did not cross the line, but he walked right up to it. Mm. I thought it was a great phrase. thank you. Thank you, Justice Souter. Anyhow. And by the way, I see I live in the same town as Justice Souter, so sometimes you see him walking along the side of the road, going
That's
to
amazing.
The local store to get his flour and yeast to bake bread. Okay.
But I have to agree. I have to agree. With what I've seen of Sergeant Lammy, I think that perfectly describes kind of what he does. He will be on the line. He'll be on the line. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a sort of different flavor than, you know, say a McGill.
But I'll say this. I will say this, that everybody that spoke to who was in law enforcement, who served at the same time as him, even the ones who were like, well, sometimes he did things that maybe, you know, I wouldn't have done. One thing for sure, nobody ever, ever accused him of being unethical or corrupt mm-hmm. or being the kind of detective who would, like, for example, plant evidence. You know, like, nobody ever described him as being dirty. There's no evidence that he would ever do anything of that sort. So it seemed like he was really on the up and up, but just his methods, you know, sometimes produced the wrong results, even results he probably wouldn't have wanted.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, throughout the different seasons of Undisclosed, this has been a thing where we see cops that sometimes get in their head that this is the guy, and they find evidence that supports that theory, or at least it's the confirmation bias thing, right? And so I don't know if we get that. And you have said several times in this season that the cops here don't necessarily have that reputation. Nobody is really saying those things, and it leads us to, you know, understand that sometimes people, officers who have good intentions and play by the rules, also make mistakes.
Yeah. No, I think all the officers involved are good officers. I mean, we've had cases in which you are dealing with dirty cops where they are literally tampering with witnesses and evidence and, you know, but that's not what we're seeing here at all.
Yeah. And I do love those kinds of stories too, but it's another great cautionary tale. And one of the great reasons why Undisclosed is a unique podcast. So Roland's method here is to say, no, I'm not going to pick up the investigation where you left off and continue this trail. I'm going to pretty much start from scratch. Sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't. You don't want to pick up the investigation if someone has been on the wrong track, right? It seems like, though, in this case, if he had just kind of picked it up there, because they were... It wasn't like they didn't really have a good suspect, right?
Right.
It was like they needed to start from scratch, right? Am I wrong?
When Sergeant Lammy testified about how he approached the case, he said, without really saying it clearly, but in so many words, he kind of seemed to dismiss the initial investigation. He was, you know, it seemed like to him, he was like, listen, they went through so many different investigators. They really didn't come up with anything. I mean, in so many words, he seemed to just be like, he didn't really have a lot of respect for whatever had been done so far. And my problem is not with him starting from scratch. My concern was when I first read that he just didn't really review the reports. And he just wanted to, he talked to people. And maybe it was just like, well, I don't want to read these 2,000 pages, which is maybe around, actually it was probably less. Maybe it was like 1,500 pages at that point. I don't want to review these. And instead, he just wanted to talk to people. He knew that there was a prime suspect. He knew these guys couldn't nail that suspect. And all he wanted to do was to find the way to nail Ken. And then go with his gut from there. But if he had taken that initial investigation seriously, I wonder how it would have changed his approach. Because I have just been confused as to why he wouldn't look at those documents and say, this guy didn't have an alibi for that night. This guy didn't need any assistance doing any of this, right? Like, to turn this into an entire conspiracy, that him and him alone is what we're dealing with. Or maybe he thought, okay, maybe he did it alone, but I can't nail him alone. And I got to find another way to nail him. And I got to involve other people. And if that was the case, and that was like a conscious thing that he did, then that is troubling. I just don't know if that's what happened.
Yeah, it would seem that in hindsight, where the first mistake that was made that sent him on the wrong road was that, well, he seemed to have a, you know, that gut feeling about Ken that he believed the motive was that Ken was the father of Lisa's baby.
Yeah, really
which
weird.
Seems, yeah. Was there any indication? Did he just pull that out of a hat or?
No, I mean, he wasn't, you know, it comes up in a couple of other reports before he took over the investigation. A couple of relatives of Sharon's had said to the police that they found Lisa's relationship with her father inappropriate. They saw her sitting in his lap and they just wondered and they were too close and that Lisa was jealous of Sharon in a weird way. But I can totally see a teenage stepdaughter being jealous of a stepmom. I mean, like, I don't find anything weird in that. But it also, over and over and over again, people said, Tony's the dad. Everybody knows who the father is. It's Tony Puff. You know, everybody knew it.
You did get to talk to Lisa. So what was her take on sort of that act? I think you put it in the episode, but, you know, the idea that Ken was the father of her baby.
Oh, she was mortified and disgusted by the idea. I mean, she's like a teenager who loves her father, but she was in love with Tony for a brief moment. She was in love with this guy and, you know, and then got pregnant. But now
it only takes a brief moment.
It only takes a very brief moment. Yeah. So she was appalled by it. And, you know, and actually even Ken was enraged by this idea when he heard that this was being insinuated. And, in fact, you know, the Thomas Sexton apologized to him. Trooper Sexton apologized to him for it. So,
This is where we're introduced to the second really important character in this story, and that's Tony Paff. And Tony, as you said, is the father of Lisa's baby. And
let me just say something before we move forward about this. And I'm going to make this correction for the next episode. His last name is spelled P-F-A-F-F, and I have been pronouncing it Faff. What I learned recently is that it's pronounced Puff, which is not what I expected, because I don't see a U or there's that extra F in it. But anyway, so I'm going to make that correction going forward, and so my apologies to the family if you're like, well, why can't get the name wrong? But apparently it's pronounced Tony Puff.
It's actually not an uncommon name here in New Hampshire. There's an influential politician, Terry Paff, and
I believe they're related.
But
but you're saying a Paff, and
I'm saying a Paff, but I could absolutely be wrong because I think it's one of those names where you know, there's like Gagnon and Gagnon. I think is you know the, like yep. the ways that they're said. I mean, people just kind of go along with it. But I understand and appreciate your desire to be accurate on that.
Yeah.
So Tony though he was. You know, in love with Lisa for a bit, and then he took off. And it sounds like you got an unexpected phone call from a relative of Tony's.
Yeah, from his sister, Laura.
Were you expecting that call?
I wasn't. I had spoken to Lisa, and again, Lisa is the mother of Tony's baby, and you know, she had said, well, I can get in touch with his sister. And then, like, within... I mean, very, very soon after I spoke to her, I think within the same hour, I got this phone call and I wasn't expecting it, but it was wonderful. And I've talked to Laura like three times now. And it's always really heartbreaking to talk to her, but she's been incredibly open and sharing and just really supportive of what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, I talk a little bit about your impressions of their upbringing because it... You know, again, it's just, it's really, really sad.
Oh, gosh. You know, I can't tell you how many times on the phone Laura, his older sister, wept. I mean, like, really just sobbed when she talked about Tony, about how they were raised. The family, I don't know all the information about why the family was split up early at some point, but at some point her and Tony were sent to live with the father. And I think there were a few other siblings that lived with the mother. Their father was just a terrifying human being. He was an alcoholic, but he was also physically abusive and sexually abusive. He raped Laura starting from, I think, the time she was around 9 years old. He began raping her. Mm-hmm. In one report, she tells the police that he also at some point started raping Tony. When she spoke to me, she said that what really broke Tony was that he, as a 6, 7, 8 year old child, was forced to witness his sister being attacked and couldn't do anything about it. And that even years later, even as adults, he would bring it up. And she had, they were at the point where she was like, stop talking about this. I can't talk about this stuff anymore. But he was just traumatized by it his entire life. And then she finally got her break and was able to go live with her mom when she was 12. But then Tony was 9 and he was left alone with this guy. And we can only imagine the things that Tony suffered after that. And really, I mean, I think in his early teens, Tony basically just started leaving home and became transient at that point and getting in trouble.
Yeah, a real, you know, traditionally what we would call an at-risk teen.
Sure.
Just a horrible upbringing. But it seems like he gets into the frame for investigators, what, because they are checking on the paternity of Lisa's baby to kind of check out the Ken being the father motive.
I mean, there is, so what, I'm not really sure why Sergeant Lammy's decided that he needed, but I think part of it was that nobody had interviewed Tony yet. And
yeah.
Sergeant Lammy's focus was like, I'm going to interview everybody that has not been interviewed that's connected to this family. Mm-hmm. I don't think he expected that when he contacted Tony, Tony was going to like drop this bomb on him that, by the way, I moved this car. Because they had no prior contact, it seemed. That was like the first time they spoke on the phone. And over the phone, as the conversation's ending, Tony's like, oh, by the way. So yeah, I don't know why, other than I think he was just kind of going through the list of people that the investigators hadn't spoken to yet. And Tony had left New Hampshire, I think in August, in the month or so after the murder, he had moved to North Carolina. So he wasn't around, and he just wasn't on the radar for the investigators for any reason. They had no reason to think he had any involvement.
Right, right. Is that where he was at the time of the call? Was
yeah,
he
was in North Carolina. Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this idea that in the middle of the, well, at the end of the call, he dropped a confession. Boy, that really, I mean, that's a surprise. I mean, we've already started talking about it. The idea that he would have, done that. Did everybody believe that immediately? As far as the investigators, they're like, oh, here we go.
Well, here's the thing, and this is something that I spent a lot of time looking at, and had my research assistant, Jennifer, also do a lot of digging around, is whether or not it was reported in the news that the car was found in a spot that had previously been searched, right? Mm-hmm. So
the mall.
The mall, right? Okay. So the car was found at the mall on July 30th, but on July 29th, that lot had been searched numerous times and the car wasn't there. We couldn't find any media reporting in any of the newspapers that reported that that lot had been searched, the car wasn't there, and it showed up the next day. What it did report was that the car was found at the mall. It just, right. There was no public information that the car hadn't been there. So the only way Tony could have known that the car wasn't there, again, Tony has no idea that the lot's been searched at all. He right. doesn't know. All he knows is that on the evening of the 29th, which would have been after the lot was searched, he was asked to move the car. So Tony just wouldn't know that the car wasn't there unless he either did it, or it was reported in the media and he knew it, or the police fed it to him, like inadvertently during an interrogation, but he wasn't being interrogated here. He was on the phone. So to me, that's what really lends credibility to this confession, I guess. And it's not really a confession so much, other than the confession part of it is that Tony didn't tell the police anything about this before. They never contacted him. So to be fair, but he also didn't, when he learned that she had been murdered, he didn't volunteer the information. And I can understand why, given his background, given his previous, you know, run-ins with the law, and he's scared. He has no idea what's going on. He doesn't want to get wrapped up. He just, can you imagine if, you know, you found out you did something for somebody and then, you know, and that, you know, like, you know, you might have just gotten yourself involved in a murder cover up. So I think that they did believe him because of the fact that he couldn't have really known that the car wasn't there before, the day before.
So walk us again through Tony's movements that night. Was he with friends going to the movies? Is that right?
What Tony says is that sometime late in the afternoon, around 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon, he calls Ken's house and he's looking for Lisa. And we know this is true. We know that he's been looking for Lisa for a while, and she doesn't want to talk to him. She's upset at him. He won't give her any money, but now he's got some money because he's been working. He's had a steady job for a few weeks. He wants to give her some money. He knows that she's moved back to Rhode Island because her and Sharon didn't get along. So he's calling the house trying to get Lisa's number. And according to him, Ken's like, well, I'll give it to you, but I need you to do something first for me. My wife's car got left at the sports center, and I need you to just move it to the Sears parking lot. And so then he did. And he said he was told just to leave the car door unlocked, leave the keys under the seat. And that's what he did. And then he did that around 8 p.m. that night.
Did he know at that time that Sharon was dead?
He would have no idea because if on the 29th, Friday the 29th, the police go to the house to tell the family that Sharon is the victim that they found that morning around 4:45 p.m. So if Tony called him around 5 or 6, like, the family's the only one that knows that Sharon's dead. And Ken didn't tell him anything. And it hasn't been reported on the news yet that she wasn't identified in the news until the next morning. So he doesn't know until the weekend, at least, that that his girlfriend or ex-girlfriend's mother was found killed. Mm. He just would have no way of knowing.
Yeah, I'm always still trying to figure out why Ken felt the need to have the car moved to some place where it would be found. If it's already someplace and eventually would be found, why felt like it needed to be found sooner? Because don't you feel like that would be the motivation of putting it in a huge parking lot where it's going to be discovered?
You know, that's also been confusing to me. I had a long conversation about this with Sarah Kalin, who is, the investigator working with me on this case. She thought that Ken might not have thought that Sharon's body would be found so quickly and identified so quickly. Although I don't know. I mean, it's a work site. People are going to be there the next day, right? I mean, like, it's not a weekend. It's, the car was left wherever he last saw her. And something about that spot would have pointed to him versus it being a place that Sharon was known to go all the time anyways, right? Like, so if Sharon's car was found, like, at the sports center, that's where he met her. And that's where he left the car. Like, that's not a place Sharon would have normally gone. So maybe he's thinking, okay, we'll make it look like she disappeared from the mall. She was abducted from the mall or something because she's always at the mall. He knows that the police are tracing where she is. Right. And you might remember from a couple episodes ago that on that night, that same Friday night, is when Ken went for a walk late at night. He lied to the police about this, went for a walk, and went and saw Mary Lou Farah. And as he was leaving, he said, oh, you know, the police can't find her car. They're looking for her car. It disappeared from the mall parking lot. Mm-hmm. Again, Ken had no reason to know that because Ken himself never volunteered to the police that Sharon had gone to the mall. And the police didn't know that she went to the mall, not until, like, the next day. I don't know what his half-fried brain was thinking, Kevin. But my guess is he thought it would just make more sense that the car's going to be found where she would naturally be expected to have gone.
Right, right. So the next step is that they have Tony make a phone call to... So many calls. Okay, so walk us through that. Because again, they're trying to get Ken to say something incriminating, and they think Tony's the guy who's going to do it.
Yeah, so now they're like, finally we have a way to get to Ken, right? Until now, they can't get anything on him enough to make an arrest. And at the top of the episode, I shared kind of apparently that's how conservative the prosecutors are in New Hampshire. And at this point, Tony hasn't implicated himself in the murder at all. He's just like, I just moved this car. I had no idea what it was about. But they take Tony to Rhode Island to try to meet Ken. And because Ken now has also moved to Rhode Island by this point. And this is about 6 to 8 months after the murder. I think about 8 months. And so he's there, Lisa's there. Tony goes there for a few days and he starts calling the house. I mean, Ken gets on. Ken's like, I don't know who you are. I don't know what car you're talking about. I have no idea. And then, you know, I mean, poor Tony makes so many calls. He tries so hard. And half the time Lisa picks up and he's got to deal with her. And she's like, what are you doing? What is this about? He wants to keep her out of it. But then finally he's like, listen, your dad definitely killed her. Your dad definitely killed Sharon. And, you know, Ken finally agrees to meet him. And then does the darndest thing. He meets with Tony and then Ken calls the police and says, I would like to report that I met this guy and he told me that he moved my wife's car. But he said that I told him to do it, but I didn't tell him to do it.
Sounds like that Ken was sort of suspicious that the cops were making him do
100%.
This, right? I think maybe that's him like trying to say, okay, well, what should I do if I'm an innocent guy? Oh, I know. I would call the cops and say, I have information. It doesn't point to me, but you should look at, you know, because if he kept that to himself, maybe they're going to say, Kojak's going to knock on his door about that.
Well, the thing about Ken and information is that every step of the way, the information is all kind of transactional for him. I mean, when it came right. to Bob, he's like, yeah, I'll give you information on Bob if you tell me the description of the guy that the witness saw, you know, arguing with Sharon that night.
Right, right.
And then he shut down completely, wouldn't share anything else. On this issue, when he called, the officers were like, well, that is very important information, sir. Come down to the station so we can take a statement. And Ken's like, nope, I got to clear my head. They tried two or three times. Ken, and they're like, you understand how important this is to your to solving who killed your wife? And Ken's like, oh, well. He refused to come down to the station. And so, Ken was lawyered up, you know, so there's only so much they could do with Ken.
Right, right. A lot of people are asking, okay, well, they had this information from Tony. How come then they didn't grab him by the collar and bring him in and have Kojak get a confession out of him? That's actually a tweet that someone sent. WTF, didn't Kojak interview Ken and force a confession out of him at that point? So in this time frame, that's why they can't bring him in and really get a lot out of him, because he's lawyered up.
Ken was lawyered up within days of the murder. I mean, so, you know, and if I'm representing somebody and they're like, well, come in and talk to us, I'd say, nope, he's not gonna. I mean, as simple as that, right? Unless you're gonna arrest him, but otherwise my client's not gonna talk to you voluntarily, and he doesn't need to. And so they can't. And the problem is, you know, with people like Tony, you know what they're doing to Tony, and this happens all the time. I mean, I think about, for example, Adnan's case and Jay Wilds, where you've got this young kid who has no financial resources. They're not arresting him yet. If they arrest you, you suddenly have the right to a public defender. But they won't arrest you. They'll just keep pressuring you to cooperate and to give statements, and you have no attorney to tell you not to do it. So, you know, they can't afford a private counsel. Tony can't afford private counsel, and he hasn't been arrested, so he has no right to state-funded counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're kind of screwed, and they're kind of at the mercy of their own, like, kind of instinct about what to do and not to do. However, Ken has a lawyer, and I'm sure his lawyer's like, nope, you don't need to talk to them at all. Do not say a single word. And that's what he did.
Yeah, I also had heard, you know, that the Attorney General's office was very conservative when it came to bringing a murder indictment or doing an arrest. Let me tell you one example here about a cold case that got solved when there was a witness to a murder. He had been at the guy's house earlier in the night. They looked at all these other people, and he said, oh, I know who did it. It was this other guy. And they did one of these phone calls, and he said, hey, remember the time that you did that? And the guy on the other end of the phone, who he said was the suspect, was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And the cops realized, oh, no, this guy isn't the witness. He's actually the killer.
Oh,
so they
God.
Got him to confess, right? And then they went to the lead homicide prosecutor. They said, we got him to confess. And they said, you know, can we bring him in? Said, no, you have to go out now and verify his confession. So they brought him home. The two cops put him in the car and drove him home for a week until they could get it. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
And dropped him off. They had done a lie detector test, and they dropped him off. And his wife said to the cops, how'd he do? And the cop said, ask him. And they drove away really fast.
Oh, my God. What a crazy story.
Yeah. And there's a couple, there's a case that was on 2020, you know, a real whodunit. And basically it comes down to this woman's either the ex-husband who was abusive but was at a wedding 4 hours away in Boston, or the really nice boyfriend who walked up to cops and said, oh, I was there last night. You got to prove I didn't do it.
Wow.
You know, it's just, again, it's like, yeah, some places maybe you just roll the dice and say, this is the guy.
Yeah. I mean, the crazy thing to me, I mean, to me, that explains why they were holding off on arresting Ken. But it doesn't explain to me why what happens next happens, which is
right,
that,
right.
You know, which is that they go after Tony and Jason. I mean, that's, I think, really, it's hard for me to understand. How do you square that circle if they are that conservative? Then, but again, I mean, we're going to be getting into confession territory in the next couple of weeks, and I guess maybe it's based on whether they think the veracity of the confessions holds up or not. And in this case, the prosecutors thought that they did.
So, Robbie, we actually have a voicemail that came in from someone that has a question about that post office box.
Hi, my name's Carrie, and I'm a listener from Indiana. The P.O. box that Ken had, I would suspect he was taking out another mortgage on the house he didn't want Sharon to know about, or opening credit cards or whatever, and maybe even a life insurance policy. But all of that he would be doing to hide from his wife. And I know it would have been far easier to get a mortgage back in the 80s without having the person who actually owned the house sign on it. So that's from my own personal job history. But that's my guess. It was something to do with getting finances he didn't want her to know about. And that would be probably to cover gambling debts. So thanks. Loving the story.
Okay, Rabia, what's up with the P.O. box?
Yeah, this is something that, like, you know, we've talked about a couple of times, and I thought this was a couple people have tweeted this at us, and, you know, I think it's very possible that Ken could use that P.O. box to hide credit card statements. The mortgage thing was interesting because I don't know what things were like then, but right today, I don't think you could get a mortgage on a property that's in somebody else's name and a bunch of cash, right?
Yeah.
I mean, credit card statements, I think, is possible that he, and frankly, he could have been getting credit cards in her name with her credentials.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the cheating thing, I think, is much more of a stretch. I don't think there's any evidence that he had other issues, you know, and I think the gambling debts and the money stuff was where he was really struggling, and also struggling to hide it all from Sharon. So I do think that's a strong theory. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons why he might have chosen to get a P.O. box in another town instead of his hometown is he didn't want somebody saying, hey, I saw Ken at the post office.
Yeah.
You know, at his P.O. box, Sharon. So, and Sharon starts going, oh, I don't know about that.
Yeah, yeah. And the P.O. box was, I mean, somebody asked this, but the P.O. box was only in his name. So, but we don't know. I mean, there's this kind of like, that's a kind of an open-ended question, really. We just, because I don't think the police, I mean, the police could have executed a search warrant, maybe, but I don't know what they could have found if they found an empty P.O. box at that point. But, you know, why any of the mail? But there's just no answer in the discovery files to that question. But I think what was interesting about that whole thing was, again, Ken lying about it. You know, that was really the bigger thing to me, is that Ken just constantly lies to the police and gets away with it.
Robbie also got another tweet here. It says, where did Tony work at the time of the murder, and did he have any priors? We know he had priors, but was he making money?
He was making money. He worked at a place called, well, actually, I mean, next episode, we're going to get all into his work records. He was working at a company that cleaned commercial kitchens, basically, and
okay.
They worked mostly at night, and you know, it's that those work records that lead the police to our defendant, finally, Jason Carroll.
We also got a tweet here, and I think we covered some of this about, it's about moving the car, whether there was some utility in that. But how far was the car moved?
Yeah, it wasn't far. So the Don's Sports Center is, no longer exists. I did try to do some digging to see if I could find an older address, but it really seems like it would have been about a 10 to 15 minute walk between where it was to where the Sears parking lot was. And Auto Center Road, which I believe that, you know, they actually were spotted there that night, is also in the same like range. I mean, we're talking, all of this happened within about a 15 minute walking distance of each other.
Yeah, that area around the mall, of course, the mall's a big piece of property, but there's a whole bunch of car dealerships there too, which take up a lot of space. So it isn't like if you were to walk from here to there, you'd be walking by 50 storefronts. You know, there's big dealerships and whatnot, so there aren't a lot of people that can spot you. Yeah. You know, Auto Center Road is that named that way because it cuts through a couple of different auto dealerships. And now there's a grocery store there, which used to be my grocery store when I lived in Manchester. Another bit of trivia that nobody cares about except me.
I'm just glad this case is just speaking to you in New Hampshire.
Oh, my God. I love it. I love it. So this tweet from John, halfway through, I'm so shook. I'm shook too, John. Was Kent charged for anything in this crime? Well, I think we might be jumping ahead. So I don't want to... I don't want to give anything away. How do you have someone confessing to moving the vehicle by direction of the husband and no charge? Well, maybe we can turn this around, that they know that this was moved. Was that not enough to go after Ken?
Yeah, you know, I was like, well, that would be the point at which I'm like, that's it, we're issuing an arrest warrant, yeah, going after it. But again, my colleague, Sarah Kalin, who was a homicide detective, it was like, well, you know, maybe you want to, that you need to like verify this more. You want to like get more around it. It might not be enough to hold up in court. And given how conservative the courts and juries there seem to be, I can understand. If they knew that, listen, and also think about like the witness who's coming forward, Tony's credibility, right? Like, how could this witness be attacked and his credibility be attacked? If they presented him as the only evidence tying Ken to this crime in a court of law. So I can see why they're like, well, we need a little bit more. It would be jumping the gun to arrest him right now. But certainly it should be enough for them to be like, this is the only guy that matters.
Yeah. It's funny how we're talking about how transactional Ken is with information and whatnot. And I was thinking this too when you mentioned about Tony, is that it doesn't seem like that Tony said that he got paid a whole bunch of money to move a car. He did it just so he could get a telephone number.
Yeah, yeah.
And it sounds like the kind of thing Ken would be willing to give up, but he wouldn't just say it. He's like, you gotta give me something in return.
Yeah, but the thing that Tony ended up doing, which is really heartbreaking, is by admitting to this little piece of information, he suddenly becomes the target of Sergeant Lammy's investigation. And I think for Sergeant Lammy, it was like, if this guy's giving us this much, there's got to be more he's not giving us. Also, probably given his history and stuff. So they spend the next, instead of really focusing, they tried the sting failed with Ken. Then they're like, okay, it's all about Tony. We have to figure out what else Tony's involvement was, what his real involvement was. It couldn't have just been this, right? Like, they think this is Tony's way, and I can understand this way of thinking, but they think that, you know, why would anybody volunteer anything about their involvement at all, right? But if it's somebody like Tony, then it's probably because he's hiding other things. And so they just really, you know, Tony put himself in the line of fire for this, and then they spend the whole summer looking for every single person that Tony's like ever come in contact with in the past 18 months to find out, like, what's the deal with Tony Puff? Like, who is this guy? What was he up to that summer? And how was he involved in the crime that he hasn't told us?
So I thought episode 5 was great. I'm loving the entire season, as you know. Can you give us a sneak peek of episode 6? Because the cliffhanger from this one is, as you mentioned, we finally hear the name Jason Carroll. What's happening in episode 6?
Yeah, in episode 6, Jason comes into the case fully. I mean, basically, just completely out of left field, but he becomes centered in this case. He becomes the key for Sergeant Lammy to basically close this case. Without him, Lammy believes he can't do it. And that's how important Jason Carroll becomes to this case. And so it's all about how Jason gets involved, who Jason is, and what Jason tells the police.
Rabia, I am, like I said, loving this season. Thank you so much for talking more about episode 5 with me.
Thank you so much, Kevin, and I hope you feel better soon.
Oh, yeah, I hope I feel better too. Thanks. Look, if you have questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can ask them on social media. Just look for the Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Thanks so much to executive producer Mithil Tilhan and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for continuing to let me be part of their work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. More to come next week.